9. Self-control. In the 18th century, the Scottish philosopher David Hume wrote that human reason is the slave of the passions. If Hume had meant by passions what we mean by that word today, his observation wouldn't be worth noting. Obviously, when we're seized by intense feelings like lust or vengeance, our reasoning faculties are not running the show. But Hume meant passions in a different sense. He meant feelings, broadly speaking. He was saying that, though rational thought plays an important role in human motivation, it is, in a certain sense, never really calling the shots. When we decide to do something, we decide on the basis of a feeling. Where did Hume get this idea? Apparently through introspection, carefully watching his mind at work. In a sense, Hume was being mindful before mindfulness was cool. Indeed, as Western philosophers go, Hume was pretty Eastern. A number of his views align almost uncannily with Buddhist thought, including an argument he mounted against the existence of the self. Some scholars have suggested that this may be no coincidence, that he may have somehow encountered Buddhist ideas, even though they had barely begun to drift westward from Asia. Certainly, the idea that feelings run more of the show than we realize is Buddhist in spirit. Now, a quarter of a millennium after Hume caught up with Buddhism, science is catching up with Hume. It has developed tools to peer into our motivational machinery, to see which parts of the brain are active when we make decisions. And Hume's ideas about the relationship of reason to feeling, long considered radical, are looking pretty good. Consider a decision as straightforward as whether to buy something. It's tempting to think of this as an exercise in rational deliberation. You look at the product and the price, and then you ask yourself a series of questions. How much would you use the product? Would the purchase take a big chunk of your cash? What else could you buy with that money? After answering such questions, you coolly weigh the factors for and against the purchase and decide. But weighing factors may not be so cool after all, according to an experiment done by cognitive scientists at Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, and MIT. They gave people real money and offered them a series of things to buy: wireless headphones, an electric toothbrush, a Star Wars DVD, and so on. As these people were shown each product and then its price, their brains were being scanned. It turned out researchers could do a good job of predicting whether someone would purchase something by watching which parts of the brain got more active and which got less active. And none of these were parts of the brain mainly associated with rational deliberation. Rather, they were parts associated with feelings, like, for example, the nucleus accumbens, which plays a role in doling out pleasure and gets more active when people anticipate rewards or see things they like. The more active the nucleus accumbens while subjects were looking at a product, the more likely they were to buy it. On the other hand, there's the insula, which gets especially active when people anticipate pain and other unpleasant things. The more active the insula got when people were shown the price, the less likely they were to buy the product. Though weighing the pros and cons of a purchase sounds like a purely rational, even mechanical act, this experiment suggests that the way the brain actually does the weighing is through a contest of conflicting feelings. Even the factor of price, a purely quantitative index, the kind of thing that is easily fed into a computer's decision-making algorithm, ultimately enters the equation in the form of a feeling, a degree of aversion. And the stronger feeling, attraction or aversion, wins. To be sure, these feelings may be informed by reason. If you remind yourself that the last electric toothbrush you bought went unused and infer that this is the likely fate of your next electric toothbrush, any feeling of attraction to the toothbrush may fade. If you remind yourself that the $20 they're asking for the toothbrush is less than you spent on dinner last Friday, your aversion to the price and activity in your insula may weaken. Why feeling governs thought. So reason does play a role in what a person finally does. Still, this experiment suggests that maybe reason can play that role only by influencing the ultimate motivator, feelings. As Hume put it, reason alone can never be a motive to any action of the will. Buying something ultimately comes down to feeling good about the purchase, or at least feeling better than walking away from the purchase feels. Of course, you may later regret walking away. Non-buyer's remorse is as real as buyer's remorse. But either way, the key word is remorse. The Monday morning quarterbacking comes in the form of a feeling, because that's the form the Sunday quarterbacking assumed in the first place. This all makes sense when you think about it in evolutionary terms. After all, feelings are the original motivators. Good and bad feelings are what natural selection used to goad animals into, respectively, approaching things or avoiding things, acquiring things or rejecting things. Good feelings were assigned to things like eating, and bad feelings to things like being eaten. Over time, bit by bit, animals got smarter. But the point of smarts, from natural selection's perspective, isn't to replace feelings, but rather to make them better informed. Intelligence helps animals do a more sophisticated job of figuring out what to approach or avoid, acquire or reject. That is, what to feel good about or bad about. So, over evolutionary time, though the calculations that inform our feelings get more and more elaborate, the feelings continue to be what ultimately steer us through life. We may buy a parka with a lining whose virtues we've confirmed through rigorous online research and extended contemplation. But the reason we finally buy the parka is because all that rational analysis gives us a good feeling about buying it. For that matter, the reason we started the analysis in the first place is because being cold in the winter gives us a bad feeling. Feelings tell us what to think about, and then, after all the thinking is done, they tell us what to do. Over the history of our evolutionary lineage, thinking has played a larger and larger role in action, but the thinking has always had both its beginning and its end in feelings. Another thing that can happen over evolutionary time is that feelings are assigned to more and more things. As our species became more complexly social, getting food and sex came to depend on navigating a social landscape, which included goals like forging alliances and being held in high esteem. So making friends and earning respect came to feel good, and being rejected came to feel bad. This in turn opened up new avenues of thought. Figuring out why a friend turned on you, imagining ways to impress people, and so on. Still, this growing web of feelings and thoughts was a straightforward extension of the basic value system evolution built into us to begin with, a system that prized surviving and getting our genes spread. Natural selection being the thrifty thing it is, the biology behind those feelings and thoughts was a straightforward extension of the biology embodying those original values. Brain scan studies have shown that the same parts of the brain that mediate physical pain also mediate the pain of social rejection, which helps explain why opiates and other painkillers can take the sting out of social setbacks. Even extended doses of Tylenol, one study showed, can dull the pain of social rejection. Reason and chocolate. All of which brings us to the subject of chocolate. A bar of Godiva chocolate, as it happens, was one of the items on offer in that MRI shopping study. But even if it hadn't been, I'd probably be bringing up chocolate now, because I'm trying to steer us toward the subject of self-control. And when it comes to self-control, chocolate ranks pretty high on my list of challenges, right up there with powdered sugar donuts and watching sports on TV rather than writing this book. Self-control has often been described as a matter of reason prevailing over feelings. Plato invoked the metaphor of a charioteer, the rational self, keeping horses, the unruly passions, under control. This basic idea has survived more or less intact for about 2.5 millennia. In fact, some people say that brain science has located the charioteer. The prefrontal cortex, which sits right behind your forehead, is extolled in high school textbooks and museum exhibits as the thing that makes you human. It is said to be the executive seat of the brain, endowing us with a capacity for extended reasoning and planning and self-control. You can tell that our ancestors, the Australopithecines, were lacking in these departments. Just look at the embarrassingly sharp slope of their foreheads. Certainly the prefrontal cortex is an important thing. I'm as proud of mine as the next guy. What's more, there is good reason to believe that this part of the brain plays some important role in what we think of as self-control. Studies show that the more formidable a temptation, the more activity there is in the prefrontal cortex of people who resist it. Still, if Hume is right, this prefrontal activity shouldn't be framed as it's commonly framed, as reason overcoming temptation or successfully opposing feeling. Reason has its effect not by directly pushing back against a feeling, but by fortifying the feeling that does do the pushing back. Yes, that Hershey bar looks good, and the thought of eating it feels good, but reflecting on that article you read about the toll high blood sugar takes on your body makes the thought of eating the Hershey bar guilt-inducing. And it's the guilt, not the reflection, that does direct combat with the urge to eat the candy bar. Reason alone, Hume argued, can never oppose passion in the direction of the will. Nothing can oppose or retard the impulse of passion but a contrary impulse. In this view, the prefrontal cortex isn't a kind of command module that evolution invented when we got promoted from mere animals to human beings. It's not something that finally tamed our unruly feelings and put us under rational control. No, the powers of reason embedded in the prefrontal cortex are themselves under the control of feelings. The value system embedded in the feelings, natural selection's conception of what's good and what's bad, what we should pursue and what we should avoid, continues to be, more or less, the prevailing value system. Natural selection has made us want foods with certain kinds of tastes, and has also made us want to live a long, healthy life. The struggle for self-control, in this particular case at least, is a clash between these two values and between feelings associated with these two values. If reason is to play a role in the struggle, it is only as a proxy for these values. It's the desire to live a long, healthy life that focuses our reasoning on the link between sugar consumption and longevity. And it's through this desire that the results of the reasoning can overpower the desire for the chocolate itself. It's in this sense that reason remains a slave to the passions, as Hume put it, and thus a slave to natural selection's overarching value system. The more we learn about the functioning of the brain, the more sense Hume's view makes. Joshua Green, a neuroscientist at Harvard, has written of a particular region in the prefrontal cortex called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The DLPFC, the seat of abstract reasoning, is deeply interconnected with the dopamine system, which is responsible for placing values on objects and actions. From a neural and evolutionary perspective, our reasoning systems are not independent logic machines. They are outgrowths of more primitive mammalian systems for selecting rewarding behaviors, cognitive prostheses for enterprising mammals. In other words, as Green himself notes, Hume seems to have gotten it right. It isn't just the prefrontal cortex that's long been oversimplified. The part of the brain known as the limbic system is routinely identified as the seat of emotion, but that description is turning out to be misleading. The neuroscientist Luis Pessoa has written, "Affective brain regions participate in cognition on the one hand, and cognitive brain regions participate in emotion In his textbook, The Cognitive Emotional Brain, Pessoa, like many writers in the history of psychology, invokes Plato's chariot image, but unlike most of them, he brings it up for the purpose of rejecting it. Does your inner judge really judge? It's no surprise that Plato's view, the idea of a purely rational charioteer, has held sway for so long. After all, when you're deciding whether to indulge in, say, chocolate, doesn't it feel as if there's a rational you that's pondering the question, a kind of judge who hears the arguments for and against buying the chocolate? On the one hand, you're a few pounds overweight. Plus, eating the chocolate this late in the day could make it harder to sleep. On the other hand, if you ate the chocolate, you'd feel energetic and could get some work done. Plus, you deserve a treat, given how hard you worked yesterday, thanks in part, perhaps, to the chocolate you ate. Having considered the arguments on both sides, you, the judge, render a verdict. Being a stern judge, you decide that, no, you cannot have the chocolate today. Or maybe on another day, being a lenient judge, you decide that you have indeed earned the chocolate bar. And court is adjourned. Or rather, court is recessed. After you buy the chocolate, you will begin adjudicating the question of whether to wait until you get home before eating it. Either way, it does feel as if there's a moment where you decide. So what's wrong with describing it this way, as a rational you adjudicating the case? I once asked this question of Rob Kurzban. Since Kurzban is among the psychologists who have suggested that maybe the self doesn't exist, I was pretty sure he'd have a way of describing the chocolate decision that didn't involve some rational you being the judge. And indeed, when I asked him what's wrong with saying something like, "I considered the pros and cons and decided not to eat the chocolate," he said that, strictly speaking, you should put it more like this. There were certain systems in your head that were designed to be motivated to eat high-calorie foods, and those systems had certain kinds of motives or beliefs or representations, and there are other systems in your head that have motivations associated with long-term health, and those systems have certain beliefs about the chocolate. In the end, modules of the second kind, modules focused on the long-term, inhibited the behavior that was being facilitated by the short-term modules. In other words, neither kind of module was more rational than the other. They just had different goals, and on this particular day, one was stronger than the other. You might ask, what exactly do we mean by stronger? Well, if Hume was right, and the drift of that shopping experiment was right, it comes down to a contest of feelings. A long-term module may generate a sense of guilt when you reach for that chocolate bar. It may also give you a feeling of pride when you resist the allure of chocolate. On the other side of the contest is the chocolate lust generated by the short-term module. But the short-term module may have subtler tactics as well. Is it, perhaps, the module that dredged up the memory of that article about the long-term benefits of antioxidants? It just thought the long-term module might find that article interesting? All of this highlights a puzzle. Why does our conscious mind have to spend time witnessing the presentation of reasons, that is, participating in the deliberation? If it's just a show trial, if it all comes down to a contest of power between modules that have summoned whatever fortifying logic might support their cause, couldn't the whole thing happen subconsciously, freeing up the conscious mind to do something constructive, like ponder the mind-body problem? Well, recall that the conscious mind, being the part of your mind that communicates with the world, seems to be a kind of public relations agent. My guess, said Kurzban, is that the reason your conscious mind observes the debate, including the winning rationale, is so that if someone ever challenges you or asks you why you did X, Y, or Z, you'll be able to cite a plausible rationale. So if you're walking out of a store jamming a 3.5-ounce chocolate bar into your mouth, and a passerby looks at you quizzically, you can say, "This is so I can get more work done this afternoon," presumably, the passerby will then think more highly of you than if you'd said, "I'm out of control, okay?" Sometimes the social stakes are higher than what a passing stranger thinks of you. If everyone you know finds out you've been cheating on your spouse, you can't just say, "I was driven by sexual urges that were designed by natural selection to maximize genetic legacy." Then people will go around saying you're the kind of person who cheats on a spouse. And of course, you're not that kind of person. So you need to be able to say something more like, "But you have to understand, my spouse had grown emotionally distant and wasn't meeting my deep need for companionship and intimacy." Then people will say they can't really blame you. So it helps to have already heard that side of the argument and watched it carry the day before you decide to have the dalliance. Then you're ready. This isn't to say that the only reason we're conscious of our reasoning process is so we can sell rationales for our behavior to a gullible public. Sometimes, while deliberating on a big decision, we consult with friends or family about what we should do, and this consultation will be more productive if we're already aware of some arguments for and against the decision. Of course, even here, there may be a public relations agenda. Consulting may be a way of making sure in advance that we're not going to do something that will antagonize important people in our lives, or a way of getting commitments of support from these people in case our decision antagonizes other people. But, especially when we're talking to people who have our interests at heart, consulting may actually mean consulting, seeking guidance. Either way, one virtue of your conscious mind being in touch with the reasons generated by competing modules is that you can share the reasons with others and get their feedback before making your decision. Strictly speaking, though, the way I should put it is this. You can share the reasons with others, and then their feedback will recalibrate how good or bad the two options feel. You may have noticed a trend in this chapter. The more we ponder the connection between reason and feeling, the dimmer the prospects seem for keeping our behavior under truly rational control. First, we learned that Hume seems to have been right. Our reasoning faculty isn't ever really in charge. Its agenda, what it reasons about, is set by feelings, and it can influence our behavior only by in turn influencing our feelings. Then we learned that, actually, even the term reasoning faculty suggests more in the way of orderly deliberation than is typical of the human mind. The view emerging here is that we don't so much have a reasoning faculty as reasoning faculties. Modules seem to have the ability to recruit reasons on behalf of their goals. This in turn suggests that reasoning is sometimes a euphemism for what these reasoning faculties do. Sure, one module may say something truly reasonable and well documented, like, "If you eat the chocolate, you'll have trouble sleeping." But another module may say something like, "You'll do more work if you eat the chocolate," even if history shows that what you'll actually do is peruse social media with unusual fervor. And it's hard to separate the valid reasons from the invalid reasons, because sometimes the least valid reasons feel good, and feelings tends to carry the day. But cheer up. Just because feelings are critical players in this drama doesn't mean we're powerless to intervene. In fact, we have a tool, mindfulness meditation, that's well suited to intervening at the level of feelings and altering their influence. So maybe there's hope for dealing with the challenge classically associated with self-control, the overindulgence of various kinds of appetites. In fact, it turns out there are specific meditative techniques being used to help people deal with such challenges as addiction to cigarettes. But before we get to those, it will help to understand how and why some appetites become dominant in the first place, what the evolutionary logic is behind the power they've amassed within your mind. Is self-discipline really the problem? If you smoke cigarettes, or for that matter, if you have an addiction to anything, ranging from heroin to pornography to chocolate, there has probably been at least one occasion when you deliberated at length over whether to indulge in this form of gratification. Maybe it was back when, having tried it a few times, you recognized its allure and at some level realized that it might eventually become your master. In any event, the deliberations must have at some point gone in favor of short-term gratification. And as time wore on and opportunities for gratification kept arising, you spent less and less time deliberating. The drive for immediate gratification became so strong that resistance was futile. That's the way these things work. High school football coaches have a way of describing this dynamic. They say that self-discipline is like a muscle. If you use it, it gets stronger, and if you don't, it gets weaker. This truism does seem to capture the broad pattern. If the part of you that's arguing against indulgence prevails a few times, if it gets successfully exercised, its chances of success will be better next time. Whereas if it loses a few times in a row, it will be headed toward a very long losing streak. In fact, this muscle metaphor is so apt that some psychologists who study these things have used it to describe the upshot of their findings. An interesting question these psychologists tend not to ask is why the muscle metaphor is apt. In other words, why is it that early successes at self-discipline lead to more successes, whereas early lapses lead to more lapses? If self-discipline is really good for the organism, you wouldn't expect natural selection to make it so easy for a few early lapses to destroy self-discipline. Yet there's no denying that a few injections of heroin can be the end of a productive life. Why? One way to answer the question is to depart from the useful but limiting self-discipline as muscle metaphor. Let's translate the question into modular terms. After the module favoring indulgence wins a few debates, its strength grows to a point where countervailing modules don't even bother trying to muster counterarguments. Why would natural selection design things that way, such that the winning module gets stronger and stronger? Imagine an ancestor of yours 20,000 years ago, your great-great-great, and so on, grandfather. Imagine him as a very young man. Imagine that one of his modules, roughly the one Freud called libido, is encouraging him to make sexual advances toward a woman. Another module is counseling caution, saying things like, "But maybe she'll reject your advances and you'll be humiliated, and maybe she'll tell people that she rejected your advances and you'll be further humiliated." Or if she already has a mate, the cautious module may say, "What if she tells her brawny husband about your unwanted advances and he feeds you to a lion?" Now let's say the first module wins and your ancestor makes the advances. And let's say it turns out the libidinous module was right. The advances are not rebuffed, sex ensues, and the brawny husband is none the wiser. Well, next time there's a conflict between these two voices, one counseling sexual advance and the other counseling restraint, doesn't it make sense to give the benefit of the doubt to the first voice? After all, it was right last time. And the fact that it was right suggests two things: that it's not outlandish to think women would find this particular ancestor attractive, and that this ancestor's brain is good at picking up on cues of interest projected by women. If, on the other hand, these advances had been rebuffed, and your ancestor had been humiliated and had become the laughingstock of the hunter-gatherer village, or worse still, was roughed up by a brawny husband before becoming a laughingstock, then things would be different. Then it would make sense to give the libidinous module less power next time around. And it would make sense to give the module counseling restraint more power. After all, it was right last time. The point is just that it makes sense that natural selection would design a modular mind this way, that winning modules would amass more power when their judgment is vindicated. And note that the form vindication takes in at least some cases, is sensual gratification. If the libidinous module counsels sexual assertion, and this leads to an orgasm, then its counsel will carry more weight next time. Of course, in a modern environment, this dynamic works differently. A module that counsels going to a porn site can lead to sexual gratification, so this counsel will carry more weight next time around, even though spending time at porn sites isn't doing anything to enhance your reproductive prospects and may even have the opposite effect. Or a module counsels snorting cocaine, and this gives you a self-esteem boost that, back in a hunter-gatherer environment, would have been the reward for impressing your peers, and would have strengthened not a module that urged you to snort cocaine, but a module that urged you to repeat whatever behavior had impressed your peers. It's in this way that, in a modern environment, gratification can reinforce behaviors quite different from the kinds of behaviors it was designed to reinforce. There are two virtues of describing the self-control problem this way: as a module getting stronger and stronger, rather than as some all-purpose muscle called self-discipline getting weaker and weaker. First, this perspective helps explain why the problem would be so treacherous in the first place. It's hard to imagine why natural selection would design a muscle called self-discipline in such a way that a few early failures lead to enduring impotence. But it's easy to imagine why natural selection would design modules that get stronger with repeated success, and why natural selection would use, as its working definition of success, gratification in one sense or another. A new approach. The second virtue of conceiving the problem of self-discipline in modular terms is that it can suggest new ways of addressing the problem. There's a difference between thinking of the goal as strengthening the self-discipline muscle and thinking of the goal as weakening a module that has grown dominant. If you take the former approach, the tendency is to fight your temptations. You feel an urge to go buy cigarettes, and you try to push the thought out of your mind. After all, there's this thing called self-discipline, and you have to exercise it. You have to get it out on the battlefield to vanquish the enemy. But suppose you think of the problem as instead being this particular module that has formed a particular strong habit. How would you try to overcome the problem then? You might try something like mindfulness meditation. To see what I mean, let's take a look at the state-of-the-art mindfulness meditation approach to overcoming addictions. This approach was explained to me by Judson Brewer, who did a study on it at Yale Medical School, and also did one of the main studies showing that meditation quiets the default mode network. Brewer said the basic idea is to not fight the urge to, say, smoke a cigarette. That doesn't mean you succumb to the urge and light up a cigarette. It just means you don't try to push the urge out of your mind. Rather, you follow the same mindfulness technique that you'd apply to other bothersome feelings: anxiety, resentment, melancholy, hatred. You just calmly, or as calmly as possible, under the circumstances, examine the feeling. What part of your body is the urge felt in? What is the texture of the urge? Is it sharp, dull, and heavy? The more you do that, the less the urge seems a part of you. You've exploited the basic irony of mindfulness meditation. Getting close enough to feelings to take a good look at them winds up giving you a kind of critical distance from them. Their grip on you loosens. If it loosens enough, they're no longer a part of you. There's an acronym used to describe this technique: RAIN. First you recognize the feeling, then you accept the feeling rather than try to drive it away, then you investigate the feeling and its relationship to your body. Finally, the N stands for non-identification, or equivalently, non-attachment, which is a nice note to end on, since not being attached to things was the Buddha's all-purpose prescription for what ails us. Brewer described this therapy as being about not feeding the urge to smoke. He said, "If you don't feed a stray cat, it quits coming to your door." I like this metaphor, with its suggestion that somewhere within you, there's an animal that needs taming. After all, the modular model of the mind holds that, in a sense, there are a number of animals in your mind, modules that have a certain amount of independence and sometimes struggle with one another for dominance. What's more, I've just suggested that, as with animals, the behavior of modules is shaped by positive reinforcement. If they keep getting rewarded for something, they'll do it more and more. That, apparently, is what addiction is. A rat learns that if it presses the bar, a food pellet comes out. One of your modules learns that if it generates the urge to light up a cigarette, it will get some nicotine. This comparison puts a finer point on the difference between fighting the urge to smoke and addressing the urge mindfully. Fighting the urge is like pushing the rat away every time it approaches the bar. This works in the short run. If the rat can't press the bar, no food pellet will come out, and maybe after a while the rat will even give up on approaching the bar. Still, whenever the rat is allowed to get near the bar, it will press it, because it has seen nothing to indicate that pressing the bar won't bring food. Treating the urge mindfully, I'd say, is more like arranging it so that when the rat presses the bar, no food pellets come out. The urge, the thing that's analogous to pressing the bar, is allowed to fully form, yet it doesn't get reinforced, because your mindful inspection of it has deprived it of its force, and so broken the connection between the impulse and the reward. Over time, after the urge has blossomed again and again without bringing gratification, the urge ceases and desists. That is, if the technique works. And in the cigarette smoking study Brewer conducted, this technique worked better than an alternative approach recommended by the American Lung Association. Attention deficit as addiction. Most of our self-control problems aren't as dramatic and clear-cut as classic addictions like nicotine and cocaine. Some of them are so subtly interwoven into our lives that we don't think of them as self-control problems at all. For example, when I was a child, I had a short attention span. Actually, I still have it. It's just that now they don't call it a short attention span. They call it attention deficit disorder. What these two terms have in common is a particular way of characterizing the problem. They make it sound like there's a faculty people have, the faculty we call attention, and somehow my particular faculty of attention lacks something or other that would make it work better. Yet when I watch my attention deficit disorder in action, when I pay really close attention to the dynamics of distraction, that characterization starts to seem wrong. The problem of losing focus starts to seem more like a problem of managing my feelings. For example, right now I'm focused on writing this sentence, and writing this sentence feels fine. I like to succeed at things. And as long as this sentence keeps unfolding on my computer screen, I'm succeeding at something. But if I get to a point where I can't decide what sentence should go next, I'll start feeling a bit uncomfortable. And if it isn't just a question of how to word the next sentence, if it's a larger question about what the next sentence should say, and indeed where this whole stream of writing should head, I feel really uncomfortable. I like fiddling with sentences, but I hate pondering structural problems. But wait, there's an alternative to the discomfort of confronting an unwritten and not obviously writable sentence. My browser is open, and it has occurred to me that I should do some shopping. I need a new smartphone. I mean, I don't have to have a new smartphone, but my old smartphone has developed this weird problem where it thinks the headphones are plugged in even when they're not. So if somebody calls me, I can't hear what they're saying unless I either plug in the headphones or switch the speakerphone on. Can you imagine trying to go through life with such a burden? Don't you think I should spend the next few minutes researching smartphones? Well, whether you do or not, I am a gadget freak, so the thought of doing that feels good. Way, way better than the thought of figuring out what sentence should go next. Case closed. See you later. I'm not sure which module injected this "why don't you research smartphones" thought into my mind. Apparently, a module that likes acquiring possessions. In any event, the module timed the thought masterfully, for just the moment when writing was starting to feel uncomfortable. Modules are crafty that way. Anyway, the main point is that you can think of the problem of distraction as analogous to the problem of quitting smoking. And if you think of it that way, think of your goal as being to weaken the module that favors leading you away from work. This might affect how you address the problem. Ordinarily, if you were determined to stay focused on your work, notwithstanding a strong desire not to stay focused on your work, you might respond to the thought of researching smartphones with a reprimand. No, don't think about smartphones. Get back to writing. But if you take the mindful approach, you say, "Go ahead, think about smartphones. Close your eyes and imagine how it would feel to search for the latest review of the latest smartphone. Imagine the feeling of wanting a cool new smartphone and wanting to search online for one. Then examine it some more. Examine it until it loses its power. Now, get back to writing." Though we don't generally think of nicotine addiction and a short attention span as having much in common, both really are problems of impulse control. And in both cases, we can, in principle, weaken the impulse by not fighting it, by letting it form and observing it carefully. This deprives the module that generated the impulse of the positive reinforcement that would give it more power next time around. Hatred as addiction. In principle, you can describe much of mindfulness meditation this way, as depriving modules of the positive reinforcement that has given them power. Because often when you mindfully observe feelings, you're keeping the module that generated them from getting some sort of reward. If you observe a feeling of hatred for someone and just keep observing the feeling, then the feeling won't do what it might otherwise do. Like, say, get you to imagine taking revenge for whatever this person has done to earn your hatred. If you did indulge in this revenge fantasy, it would feel good, right? What is more delightful than imagining a horrible fate befalling a mortal enemy? And the reason this is a good feeling, presumably, is that this is the kind of thing natural selection designed the module to get you to do. To imagine ways to undermine rivals and harm enemies. So, from natural selection's point of view, the module deserves a reward for accomplishing the mission of getting you to indulge in a revenge fantasy, and this reward will make the module stronger next time around. This isn't the only mission hatred is designed to accomplish. It is also good at getting you to say hateful things about the people you hate, thus failing to exercise what Buddhists call right speech, one of the eight factors in the Eightfold Path. Saying those hateful things feels good as well. But this positive reinforcement, like the positive reinforcement for having revenge fantasies, will never happen if, when you see the feeling of hatred coming, you view it mindfully rather than surrender to it. In short, though we classically associate the term self-control with obvious self-indulgence, shooting heroin, scarfing down chocolate, and so on, it turns out that the lessons learned from these conspicuous cases go well beyond them. Hatred and a short attention span are problems of self-control and can be addressed through mindfulness. Self-control is a slightly ambiguous term. Some people think of it as referring to control of the self, and some people think of it as referring to control by the self. Either way, it's an odd term to be using in a book informed by Buddhism, since, according to Buddhism, the self doesn't exist. And if the self doesn't exist, how can we talk about self-control? If there is no rational charioteer, how do we decide, say, to do mindfulness meditation? For now, I'll finesse that question by repeating what I said earlier. Don't get hung up on whether something called a self exists. just use the parts of the not-self doctrine that are useful. In particular, the idea that none of your feelings, the urge for cigarettes, the urge to research smartphones, the urge to hate, is intrinsically a part of you. You can observe these feelings for what they are, things that some module is trying to give force to. The more you observe them this way, observe them mindfully, the less force they will have, and the less a part of you they will be. David Hume himself, though he argued against the existence of the self, certainly thought that what we call self-control is possible. He distinguished between the violent passions, such as revenge and hatred, and the calm passions, such as the love of beauty, and observed that, generally speaking, the violent passions have a more powerful influence on the will, though 'tis often found that the calm ones, when corroborated by reflection and seconded by resolution, are able to control them in their most furious movements. It's even possible, he wrote, for the calm passions to have absolute command over the mind. Mindfulness meditation is, among other things, an attempt to give the calm passions more power and give the violent passions less power. Hume, notwithstanding speculations about his having encountered Buddhist philosophy, doesn't seem to have known about mindfulness meditation. However, when he described the benefits of empowering the calm passions, he sounded like a modern-day meditation teacher extolling the virtues of living in the present. He wrote that if we fail to empower the calm passions, if we let the violent passions carry the day, we will miss the relish in the common occurrences of life. Helping people with self-control problems is often thought of as a sheerly therapeutic exercise, and certainly helping people quit smoking or get off heroin qualifies as therapy in the common sense of the term. But when you see how seamlessly the discussion of self-control leads to discussion of overcoming hatred, and for that matter, of seeing beauty in the common occurrences of life, you can see how blurry the line is between therapy and moral edification, and between therapy and spiritual uplift. This isn't surprising. According to Buddhist philosophy, both the problems we call therapeutic and the problems we call spiritual are a product of not seeing things clearly. What's more, in both cases, this failure to see things clearly is in part a product of being misled by feelings. And the first step toward seeing through these feelings is seeing them in the first place, becoming aware of how pervasively and subtly feelings influence our thought and behavior. Over the next few chapters, we're going to get to even subtler levels of this influence, and we're going to get further along the spectrum from therapy to spirituality.